Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 2, Number 10.
The first question. Until the Jews and Arabs and other tribes brought their racially exclusive and jealous God to the West, Tomi, Bacchus, Mythos, and Apollo were the gods that man worshipped. Diana had her bow and arrow. Thor was in the north. The mother goddess was worshipped in the West. And then death and resurrection became the religion of the West. Guilt and sin were taught. Why is Adam a sinner? Why is not he like Theseus or Jason or Hermes? Is the concept of sin just a trick to make men meditate? I am a pagan. There is no God for me except this existence. God is intrinsic to life. God is not outside life. God is this very life. To live this life totally is to live a divine life. To live this life partially is to live an undivine life. To be partial is to be irreligious. To be total and whole is to be holy. The questioner asks about the past. In the past, all over the world, people were pagans, simple nature worshippers. There was no concept of sin. There was no question of guilt. Life was accepted as it is. There was no evaluation, no interpretation. Reason has not interfered yet. The moment reason starts interfering, condemnation comes. The moment reason enters in, division, split starts, and man becomes schizophrenic. Then you start condemning something in your being. One part becomes higher, another part becomes lower, and you lose balance. But this had to happen. Reason had to come. This is part of growth. As it happens to every child, it had to happen to whole humanity too. When the child is born, he is a pagan. Each child is a born pagan. He is happy the way he is. He has no idea what is right and what is wrong. He has no ideals. He has no criterions. He has no judgment. Hungry, he asks for food. Sleepy, he falls asleep. That's what Zen masters say is the uttermost in religion. When hungry, eat. When feeling sleepy, go to sleep. Let life flow. Don't interfere. Each child is born as a pagan. But sooner or later, he will lose that simplicity. That is part that has to happen. That is part of our growth, maturity, destiny. The child has to lose it and find it again. When the child will lose it, he becomes the ordinary man, the worldly man. When he will regain it, he becomes religious. The child's innocence is very cheap. It is a gift from God. He has not earned it. He will have to lose it. Only by losing it he will become aware what he has lost. Then he will start searching for it. And only when he searches for it and earns it, achieves it, becomes it, then he will know the tremendous preciousness of it. What happens to a saint? He becomes a child again. Nothing else happens to a saint. He is again innocent. He went into the world of reason, division, ego, 1001 ideas. He became almost mad with evaluation, and then one day finding it all just absurd, stupid, he drops it. But this second childhood is far more valuable than the first childhood. The first childhood was just given to you. You were not even asked. It was a pure gift. And we cannot value gifts. You value a thing only when you make effort for it, when you strive for it, and when it takes a long journey to come to it. There is a Sufi story. A man, a seeker, came to a Sufi mystic and he asked, "I am searching for my master." "Sir, I have heard you are a wise man. Can you tell me the characteristics of a master? How am I to judge? Even if I find my master, how am I going to decide that he is my master? I am a blind man. I am ignorant. I don't know anything about it." And without finding a master, it is said, no one can find the gods. "So I am in search for a master. Help me." And the master told few things. He said, "These are the characteristics. You will find the master in such a way, with such a behavior, and he will be sitting under such a tree. And he will be wearing such a robe. And his eyes will be like this." And the man thanked the old man and went for search. 30 years passed, and the man roamed almost all over the world, but he could not find the man who was his master according to the old man's valuation. Tired, exhausted, frustrated, he comes back to his hometown and sees the old man. The old man has become very, very old. But the moment he comes and the old man is sitting under the same tree, suddenly he sees this is the tree the old man had said. And this is the robe the old man has said. And these are the eyes. And this is the silence that the old man had described. This is the benediction in the presence of the master. He is overjoyed. But a great question also arises in his mind. He bows down, touches his feet and says, "Before I surrender to you, just tell me why you tortured me for these 30 years. Why didn't you tell me right then that I am your master?" The old man started laughing and he said, "I had told you. He will be sitting under such a tree, and this is the tree I was sitting. And I had told you, this will be the robe he will be wearing, and I was wearing the same robe. I was the same man then, but you were not alert. You could not see me. You needed these 30 years journeys from one corner to another corner of the world. You needed all this efforts to recognize me. I was here, but you were not here. Now you are also here. You can see me. and I had to wait for you. It is not only a question for you that you have been traveling. Think of me, I am so old, and I cannot even die before you come back. And I have not changed the robe in case you miss me again for 30 years. I have never left for a single moment this tree. But you have come. Journey has been too long. But this is the way one discovers. God is always here, but we are not here. A child has to lose track. He has to go for 30 years pilgrimage. Every child has to lose track. Every child has to go astray. Only by going astray, only by suffering, he will attain eyes, clarity, transparency. Only by going into thousand and one things, she will start looking for the real. The unreal has to be searched. The unreal is attractive. The unreal is magnetic. And how can you know the real if you have not known the unreal? The child knows the real, but he has not known the unreal, so he cannot define the real. The child knows God, but he has not known the world, so he cannot define God. Each child comes like a saint, but has to become a sinner. Then the second childhood. If you don't attend to the second childhood, you have missed your life. So don't think and don't be worried that you have lost. Everybody has to lose. That should not be a problem. The problem is only if you go on and you never come back. If this man goes on, 30 years, 30 lives, 300 lives, 3000 lives, goes on and never comes back and never attains to the second childhood, then something has really gone wrong. Err to err is human. That is the way to learn. Go astray. Going astray is the way to come back home. Forget God so that you can remember Him. Escape from God. So one day, the thirst becomes a fire in you, and you have to come to God again. Like a hungry man, like a thirsty man. This had to happen to humanity too. Now there will be a great assertion of paganism into the world again, the second childhood. That's why Zen has become so important, so significant. Tantra has become such a significant word. Sufism, Hasidism are more important now than Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism. Why? Why Tantra? Why Tao? Why Zen? Why Sufi? Why Hasid? These are the pagan attitudes. They create the second childhood. The world is getting ready. Humanity is becoming more and more mature. This age is the age of humanity's youth. The childhood is no more. We have lost it. We have become corrupted. But don't be worried by it. That is how one attains to innocence again. And the second childhood is far more valuable than the first, because the second cannot be lost. The first has to be lost. Is bound to be lost. No child, not even a Buddha, could retain it. No child can retain it. It is in the very nature of things. When something is given to you, and you were not seeking it, and you were not even asking for it, you were not ready even to receive it. If you give a child a diamond like Kohinoor, he will play with it a little while and then throw it away. He does not know what it is. The Kohinoor is Kohinoor whether you know or not. The Kohinoor is Kohinoor. Knowledge makes no difference. But the child will throw it, fed up. He will become sooner or later. It's just a stone. How long you can play with it? Even if it is very colorful. Even if it is very shiny. But how long? For the Kohinoor to come into your life again, you will need a thirst for it. You will need a great missing, something missing inside your being. You will need a great desire. All desires should become lesser desires, and God becomes the suprememost desire, the topmost desire. God is always here. It happens to children, it happens to societies, it happens to civilizations, it happens to humanity at large too. So don't be worried about Christianity. That was part. Christianity are that kind of religion, are the religion between these two childhoods, the first and the second. They condemn. They shout that you have gone astray. Come back. They pull you back. They make you afraid. They give you great provocations that if you come back, you will attain to great prizes, rewards in heaven. If you don't come back, you are going to be thrown into hell. Hellfire is waiting for you. For eternity you will be in hell suffering. This is fear, creating fear in people so that they can come back. But out of fear, even if you come, you never come. Because fear can never become love. Fear cannot be reduced into love, cannot be converted into love. Fear remains fear, and out of fear arises hatred. That's why Christianity has created great hatred against religion. Friedrich Nietzsche is a byproduct of Christianity. If Friedrich Nietzsche says God is dead, it is just a reaction to Christianity. Too much emphasis on God, on heaven and hell. Somebody has to say it. I am all for Nietzsche. Somebody has to say that enough is enough. Stop all this nonsense. God is dead and man is free. Because man feels in bondage if you create fear. And greed, greed again is a bondage. You just see the heaven, the paradise, the firdaus, the idea of it, what it is. It is such greed, such lust. In the Mohammedans, Firdaus, heaven. It seems saints are doing nothing but copulating. Beautiful women are available. And streams of wine are flowing. And all that you need is immediately made available. And those beautiful women remain at the age 16. They never grow. And one more beautiful thing about that. They become again a virgin. Whenever a saint makes love to a woman, only saints go there. When a saint makes love to a woman, the moment he is finished, again she becomes a virgin. That is the miracle of paradise. and what your sins are doing there. It seems an argy, sexual argy. And streams of wine. Here you say, avoid wine, avoid women. For what? To gain better women and more wine in heaven? This seems to be illogical. But this is how people are provoked through greed to come back. Or fear. If you don't come through greed, then fear, then hellfire, an eternal hellfire. You have not done so much sin. Eternal hellfire is unjust. Okay, for 10 years you are thrown into hell. One can understand 15 years, 20 years, 50 years. But eternal? You have not been here eternally sinning. So how eternal punishment can be given to you? It looks too much. But that is not the point. The point is just to make people afraid. Fear and greed have been the base of many religions. And they have not been helpful. They have destroyed. They have not appealed to the courageous. They have appealed only to the cowards. And when a coward person becomes religious, the religion is bogus. Because a coward person cannot become religious. Only a courageous person can become religious. Religion needs great courage. It is a jump into the unknown. It is a jump into the uncharted sea with no maps. Is it dropping the past and moving into the future? It is going into insecurity. It cannot be out of cowardice. And in your temples and in your mosques and in your churches, cowards have gathered together. They are trembling with fear and they are full of greed, afloat in greed, aflame with greed, agog with greed. These greedy and coward people cannot be religious. The basis of religion is to drop all fear and to drop all greed and to move into the unknown. God is the unknown, the hidden. He is hidden here, in the trees, in the rocks, in you, in me. But to enter into that hidden reality, that occult, one needs great courage. It is going into dark night without any light. A Zen master was saying goodbye to one of his disciples and the night was very dark. And the disciple was a little bit afraid, scared. Because he had to pass a jungle of at least 10 miles. And it was wild. And wild animals were there. And it was night and dark night and no moon. And it was getting late. Almost half the night has passed. Talking to the master, he had completely forgotten. Seeing him a little afraid, the master says, "You look a little afraid, so I will give you a lamp." He gives a small paper lamp into his hands, lights the lamp. The disciple thanks him, goes down the steps, and the master calls him, says, "Stop!" And the master comes close, blows the flame off. And says, "A real master gives courage, does not help cowardice." You go into the dark. You be your own light. And remember, nobody else's light will be of any help. You will have to attain to your own light. Be a flame to your own being. Go into the dark. Be courageous. He says a real master never helps any cowardice. in a small act by blowing the flame off, the master gives a great message. Religion is only for the courageous. Those who followed Jesus, they were courageous people. They were not many. They were very few. You could have counted them on the fingers. Those who followed Buddha were courageous people. Christians are not courageous. Buddhists are not courageous. Those who are with me are courageous people. Once I am gone, your children and your children's children may pay their respect to me, but they will not be courageous. Religion exists only when there is an alive master to live it for you. When the master is gone, then religion becomes dead. Coward people gather together around a dead religion. Then there is no fear. They worship the scripture. They worship the word. They worship the statue. All dead things. But whenever Jesus is there, or a Buddha is there, or a Muhammad is there, they are very much afraid. They find 1001 ways to escape. They find 1001 ways to rationalize their escape. They condemn the real master. Why? The real master will not support your cowardice. He will not give you any greed anymore. You have already too much. And he will not make you afraid. His whole effort will be to take fear and greed away from you, so that you can become capable of living your life in totality. Christianity and religions like that had to happen. They had to be forgiven. Don't be angry about them. But now they have to go too. Now the world is no more in need of them. They are tumbling. They are scattering. They are dying. In fact, they are dead. But people are so blind that for them to know that their church or their temple is dead takes such a long time. They are so unconscious. They cannot understand it immediately. Christianity is dead. Hinduism dead. Islam is dead. In Islam, only a small thing lives, still has flame. That is Sufism. In Christianity, only few mystics are still alive. Otherwise, church and the Pope and the Vatican are just cemeteries, graveyards. In Hinduism, few mystics is still alive. A Krishnamurti. Somewhere a Raman. But far and few in between. Otherwise, the Shankaracharyas are dead people. But nobody goes to a living master. In Buddhism, only Zen is alive. In Jivism, only Hasidism is alive. The organized religion is not the real religion. The unorganized, the rebellious, the unorthodox, the heretic religion is the real religion, has been always so. Religion comes always as a rebellion. Its very spirit is that of rebelliousness. The days for Christianity, Hinduism, Islam are gone. In the future, a totally different kind of religion, a different kind of climate will surround the earth. Religions will disappear. There will be only a kind of religiousness. People will find their own religion individually. People will find their own prayers. their own way of praying. There is no need to follow anybody's prescribed idea. That is not the path. That is not the way of the courageous. That is the way of the cowards. And God is available. Just you have to become courageous to look into His eyes. You ask me. And then death and resurrection became the religion of the West. That's true. Christianity has never been concerned with Christ. It has been more concerned with the cross. It has not worshipped Christ. It has been worshipping the cross. Cross is a symbol of death. Why? Because death is the basic fear. Making people alert about their death makes them afraid. If you make a person very much mindful of death, every possibility is there that he will start shaking and trembling. And when a person is shaking and trembling, you can victimize him very easily. You can convert him into any nonsense. He is ready to believe anything. Just if you promise immortality, he is ready. So followers of Christianity say, those who are in the church will be saved, and those who are not in the church, we don't take any guarantee for them. They are doomed. They cannot be saved. And that's what all other religions say. This is creating fears. Bring death in their mind, they become afraid. Who will not become afraid of death? And then, an afraid man is prone to be converted into a slave very easily. And why resurrection? Death and resurrection became the foundation of Christianity in the West. Death gives you fear, and the promise of resurrection gives you greed. If you die within church, you will resurrect. You will resurrect as a divine being with all that you always wanted, with all that you always needed, beautiful, with a golden body, with an aura around you, you will be resurrected. These are fear, greed tricks, punishment, reward tricks. This is what B.F. Skinner goes on doing with his rats. Make them afraid. And they start doing things. This is what you see in a circus. Make the elephant afraid. Such a courageous animal and such a wise animal. But just make him afraid. And he starts doing foolish things for you. He will sit on a stool. He will bow down to a man. He can kill that man within a second. Even lions, seeing the whip, tremble. Just make them afraid, that's all. Even lions can be tamed, and elephants can be taught and disciplined. Create fear and reward. If the elephant follows you, give him good food. If he does not follow, starve him. A simple technique. That's what so-called religions have been doing to men. Guilt and sin were taught naturally, if you want to make people afraid, and that is the only way to exploit them. Teach them that everything is sin. All that you enjoy is sin. Death creates fear, but death is far away. After 50 years or 70 years you will die. Who bothers 70 years we will see. Right now we are not dying. Maybe old people become afraid. That's why you find old people more in churches, temples, old women, old men, women more than men, because they become more afraid. Old, dying, just on the verge. So they know now something has to be done. The life is going, is slipping by. They have to manage something for the future. Do you see young people in your churches, in your temples? And remember, wherever you see young people, there is religion alive. A young person, if he becomes interested in religion, that his religion cannot be that of fear and cannot be that of death. His religion will be of life. Many times people come to me and they say, why so many young people come to you? They come because I teach the religion of life, of love, of joy. I don't create any guilt, and I don't say, and I don't go on conditioning their minds that this is sin, that is sin. There are mistakes, but there is no sin. Mistakes, certainly there are. But a mistake is a mistake. If you are doing a mathematical problem and you make 2 plus 2 equal 5, is it a sin? It is just a mistake. It can be corrected. No need to throw you in hell forever just because you had counted 2 plus 2 as 5. It is simple, a mistake. Pardonable. All that you call sin is nothing but mistake. And mistake is the way of learning. Those people who never commit mistakes are the most stupid people because they never grow. I teach you, go on committing mistakes. Never be afraid. Just one thing remember, don't commit the same mistake again and again because that is meaningless. Be inventive. Commit new mistakes every day. Then you learn. Just don't commit the same mistake every day because that is foolish. You have committed it once, you have known it is a mistake, you were angry, and you have seen what anger is. Now, being again angry is stupid. You have seen, it is just meaningless. It is destructive. It destroys the other, it destroys you, and it does not bring anything. No flowers in you. You become less by anger. You don't become more. Love. Be kind. And suddenly you are more flowing. Bigger. Higher. You start floating. You have less weight. So learn. When you love, when you are loving, you can fly. Wings grow. When you hate, when you are angry, you become like a rock. Then gravitation is too much on you. You become heavy. Can't you see that simple? Just like 2 plus 2 is 4. Life is a learning. It is a school. That's why we have been sent here. That is the purpose. Not to punish you. I would like to change your whole idea about it. You have been taught that you have been sent here to be punished. This is absolutely wrong. You are sent here to learn. Why God should be such a torturer? Is He a sadist or something? He enjoys torturing people. And if these people who say you have been sent here to be punished, then why for the first time you were sent? There must have been your first life. Before that you had not committed anything, because how can you commit unless you come here? You cannot have committed any sins. Then why you were sent for the first time? They don't have any answer. Jainas don't have, Hindus don't have, Mohammedans don't have, they don't have any answer for it. Why man has been sent? Maybe this time you have been sent because in the past life you committed sins. Okay, but what about the first life? And if this is the first life, as Christians say, then why you have been sent here? Now they have a very absurd idea, because Adam committed sin. You have nothing to do with Adam. This is simply absurd. Somebody you don't know even, whether he ever existed or not, committed sin and the whole humanity is suffering for it. Your father committed sin and you have been sent to jail. And Adam is not even your father, not even father's father, not even father's father's father. He is the first man. And what he has done does not seem to be a sin at all. It seems simple courage. It seems simple rebelliousness. Each child needs that much is mine. God has said to Adam, don't eat the fruit of this tree. This tree is the tree of knowledge. And Adam ate it. I think anybody who has any soul will do the same. If Adam was dead and dull, then he would have followed. He must have been challenged. In fact, that is the very purpose. Otherwise, on the earth there are millions and millions of trees. Just think, if God has not sown the particular tree, it is very, very impossible that Adam would have found it. That was only one tree in the whole garden of God. And the garden is infinite. That was only one tree that God said particularly, don't eat. If you eat the fruit of knowledge, you will be expelled. My own understanding is, God was putting a challenge to him. He was trying to see whether he is alive or dead. He was trying to see whether he is capable of disobeying, whether he can say no. God was trying to see whether he is just a yes man. And Adam proved his mettle. He ate the fruit. He was ready to be thrown into the world, but he sowed his spirit. It is not sin. It is simply courage. Every child has to disobey his father one day or other. Every child has to disobey his mother one day or other. In fact, the day you disobey, that is the day you start becoming mature. Never before it. So only stupid children never disobey. Intelligent children certainly disobey. Intelligent children find 1001 ways to disobey the parents. You can look around. You will always find the intelligent child disobeying. Because he has to grow his own soul. If he goes on obeying you, when he will grow? How he will grow? He will remain dull and limp. He will not have his own soul. He will not have his own individuality. No, Adam has not committed any sin. Adam is the first saint. He disobeyed God and God wanted it. Exactly that is what God wanted. That Adam should disobey. Disobeying God, Adam will go far away into the world. He will lose his first childhood. Then he will suffer many, many mistakes. And from those mistakes he will learn. And one day he will come back as Christ, as Buddha, as Mahavira, as Krishna. He will come back. This going away is a must for coming back. This is not against God really. This is what God wanted precisely to happen. It was absolutely planned by God Himself. So I don't call it sin. Why Adam is called a sinner? He is called a sinner because your religions depend on calling you sinners, on condemning you. The more you are condemned, the more you touch their feet. The more you are condemned, the more you crawl on the earth and you beg. The more you are condemned, the more afraid you become. The more you are afraid, you need mediators. You don't know where God is. Your priest knows. Your pope knows. He has a direct line with God. If he interferes, only then you can be saved. Otherwise, your whole life is sin. Only if he persuades God for you, then you can be saved. This is the whole trick of the priest. The priest is not the really religious man. The priest is the businessman, doing business in the name of religion, exploiting. The ugliest profession in the world is not of the prostitutes. The ugliest profession is of the priests. Why is not he like Theseus or Jason or Hermes? He is. Is the concept of sin just a trick to make men meditate? Yes, it is a trick, but not to make them meditate. It is a trick to make them slaves. Meditation is a totally different thing. Meditation never comes out of fear. Meditation comes out of understanding. Meditation comes out of love, out of compassion. Meditation comes out of living your life in all climates, in all seasons, looking into each fact of life deeply, understanding it, and if it is meaningless, discarding it. If it is meaningful, choosing it. By and by, you go on collecting the essential and discarding the non-essential. Both are there. The chaff and the wheat, both are there. The roses and the weeds, both are there. And one has to make a distinction between the chaff and the wheat. One has to throw the chaff and collect the wheat. This much intelligence is needed, otherwise you cannot become a religious person. These fears don't give you understanding. They in fact cloud your mind more. They make you more unclear about life. They don't allow you to go into life totally and experience it. They are against experience. Meditation comes when you live life and you see life as it happens. Not that Buddha says anger is bad. That will not help. You will become a parrot, a pandit. But if you see in your own anger, and this understanding arises that anger is meaningless, poisonous. Not that Krishna says, leave everything to God, surrender to God. No. Following Krishna, you will not attain to God. But see how your ego is creating all kinds of miseries for you. Seeing that one day you drop the ego and you say, now I will live in a totally surrendered way. Whatsoever God wants through me will happen. I will not have any desire of my own. I will not have any will of my own. I drop my will. seeing the misery that ego brings, comes surrender. Seeing the misery that anger brings, comes love. Seeing the misery that sexuality brings, arises brahmacharya, celibacy. But one has to go through. There is no shortcut. And these things cannot be borrowed from anybody. The second question, why do you insist so much on the irrational? What is wrong with the rational? The rational is not enough rational, that is what is wrong with it. If you are a really rational person, you will see many things are irrational in life. A rational person, how he can avoid seeing that there are many irrational things in life? A rational person is bound to stumble upon many irrational facts. Your love is irrational. You fall in love with a woman. You cannot produce any reason for it. You simply shrug your shoulders. You say it happens. You may find some ways that you will say that she looks beautiful, this and that. But she does not look beautiful to anybody else. Nobody else has fallen in love with her. So it cannot be a simple case because she is beautiful, that's why you have fallen in love. In fact, just the other way is the truth. You have fallen in love, that's why she looks beautiful. And one day, get married to her. And one day suddenly she will be no more beautiful. And you will start thinking, was I mad? Why I had fallen with this woman? And you will start thinking, she is the ugliest woman in the world. Wives and husbands never look beautiful to each other. Because that love, that so-called love, that illusion, wears fast. If you never get your woman, you may love her for your whole life. That is possible. That's why Majnu goes on loving and crying, Leela, 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 because he couldn't get. He was a fortunate man. Those who get their Leelas, they know that once you get, then you start praying to God, how to get rid of. What happens? It is not beauty. Something irrational in you. Something from your unconscious that you are not aware possesses you. Now, the psychology of the unconscious has looked into the matter more deeply. The child, each child, boy or girl, carries two personalities within himself or herself. The personality of the mother and the father. Because a child is made from two biologies, two psychologies. A child is a combination of two persons, two personalities. Something is contributed by the father and something is contributed by the mother. If the child is a male child, the mother part inside him will go on looking for some woman who is almost similar. Your woman inside is nothing but your mother part inside you. And when some woman fits with your inner woman, you fall in love. But this is absolutely irrational. And exactly that happens when you fall in love with a man. You carry your father inside you. When some man fits the image, Nobody can fit the image totally. That's the trouble. You are not going to get your father as your husband ever. Your father cannot become your husband. Your mother cannot become your wife. And no two individuals are alike. This is the problem. And you are searching for your mother unconsciously. When you see suddenly a woman beautiful, that is your mother. Some way she resembles your mother, but in some way only. Maybe her voice is like your mother. Maybe her eyes have the same color. Maybe her hairs are the same color. Or maybe the way she walks is exactly the way of your mother. And you don't know it. You don't know it consciously. It is in your unconscious. It is deep hidden there in the darkness. And you fall in love. But no woman can be exactly like your mother. So sooner or later, things start coming up which are not like your mother. Then disturbance starts. Honeymoon is complete. These are irrational facts. Man, if really rational, is bound to stumble upon many, many facts which are irrational. Even your greatest mathematician and logician falls in love with a woman. Irrational. Utterly irrational. Why I insist for the irrational? Because to me, reason is just in the middle. Below reason there is irrational, the irrational of the unconscious. And above reason is again irrational, the irrational of the superconscious. And the conscious mind is a very small mind, very tiny mind. Below is an ocean. Sexuality, anger, greed, possessiveness, jealousy, violence, whole animal past is there. Whole animal past exists there in your unconscious. That is absolutely irrational. Have you not observed sometimes when a man is really angry, he looks more like an animal than he looks like a human being? When a man is really mad, he barks like a dog or roars like a lion or jumps like a tiger. Or behaves like a monkey. That's why out of anger you start feeling embarrassed and you say sorry. And you say, in spite of me, how it happened I don't know. It came from below. It came from the basement of your being. You were not aware of it. It took possession of you. Below your reason there is a vast continent of irrationality. The animals exist there, the vegetables exist there, rocks exist there. The whole past. That is the real meaning of the theory that you have been incarnated in many ways. 84,000 have been yonis. 84,000 lives on different planes you have lived. Someday you were like a rock. Something of it is still carried in your unconscious. Someday you were a plant. Something of it is still carried. The flower and the thorn both. Someday you were like a dog. And someday you were a tiger. And someday you were a fox. And all that is carried. Piled upon each other. That is there. Whenever you lose your rational, the irrational comes up and takes possession of you. Above it, again, there is super conscious. That too is irrational. There is hidden God. Below is the animal, above is God. If you fall below humanity, you become animal. If you go above humanity, you become divine. People are afraid of the irrational because they know only one kind of irrational, the below. And all great religions teach the irrational above. You have to go higher than you. You have to drop your logic. When you meditate, again that happens. When you are angry, then too it happens. Then too you are below reason. When you are meditating, you are above reason. But you go beyond reason in both the ways. When a man is mad, he is below reason. And when a man becomes a saint, he is above reason. That's why saints and madmen look a little alike. Something similar. One thing at least. They both are not in their rational minds. Below reason is a vast continent of irreason. And above reason is the whole sky of divinity, infinite sky of divinity. And Zen particularly is irrational. You cannot figure it out by your reason. I was reading a book of Aldous Huxley. He talks about the Chinese Zen master. The Chinese Zen master was giving a tea party one freezing night. Kajinji said to his disciples, "There is a certain thing. It is as black as lacquer. It supports heaven and earth. It always appears in activity, but no one can grasp it in activity. My disciples, how can you grasp it?" He was indicating the nature of Tathata, suchness, or Tao, or Dhamma. He was indicating the nature of existence itself. He was saying, there is a certain thing. Certain, he says, because there is no way to specify it. You cannot pinpoint it. It is so big. It is as black as lacquer, as black as a dark night. You can be lost into it. It is not like light, it is more like darkness. Why? Because in the light, distinctions are clear. You know this is a tree, and this is a pillar, and this is a man, and this is a woman. You know separation, distinction. In light, multiplicity arises. In darkness, the one. If suddenly it gets dark, then who is the pillar? And where is the tree? And where is the man? And where is the woman? All disappear into oneness. So that Tathata, that suchness, Tao, Dhamma, truth, are God. Any name will do. All are alike. All mean the same. All are just metaphors. It supports heaven and earth. It always appears in activity. But no one can grasp it in activity. My disciples, how can you grasp it? He was indicating the nature of Tathata, metaphorically of course. And this was no ordinary question. Zen masters ask questions in particular situations. Now it was clear. The night is freezing. The tea is ready. The samovar is humming. The fragrance of the tea is in the tea room. The master is sitting with his disciples and suddenly he asked this. Out of the blue. Now this is no time to talk great philosophy. The night is freezing and they would like to have hot tea. And the tea is ready, and now it is a dangerous question. Because if it is not answered rightly, that is the practice of Zen masters. He will tell the disciples to go home. The tea party, which has not even started, will be finished. They are not going to get the tea. The disciples of Kazenzi did not know how to reply. Not that they cannot create philosophy. Not that they cannot spin words. They can. But a Zen master is not asking for words. He is asking for insight. Unless you have experienced it, you cannot say anything. And whatsoever you say will be meaningless. Reason can propose many things, but those will not be accepted. The thing has to come from existential experience. Then finally one of them, Tai Suso by name, tried. You fail to grasp it because you try to grasp it in motion. He was indicating that when he meditated in silence, Tathatha appeared within himself. He is saying that if you are silent, unmoving, if there is no movement of the mind inside, all has stopped, the mind has halted, there is no activity, there is just wu-wei, inactivity, passivity, then it appears that Tao, that existence, that God suddenly fills you, overflows from you. You cannot grasp it while mind is moving, is in action. You cannot grasp it. But when the mind is not moving, it comes on its own accord. You cannot grasp it if you try to grasp, because to grasp means activity. But it comes when you are not even trying to grasp it, when you are just a receptacle, a womb, then it comes. It comes in a state of feminine inactivity, receptivity. He has answered very rationally. But Kazenzi dismissed the tea party before it had really begun. He was displeased with the answer. It is a rational answer. Appeals. You will also think he is saying right. But it is half. Unless that tatha can be caught into activity too, it will not be the whole. It will not be the total. If you cannot find God in the marketplace too, and you can find only in the Himalayas, then that God will be only half God. And half God is a dead God. You cannot divide God. You cannot say when you are sitting in a Himalayan cave, it is there. It arises. You need not grasp. It grabs you rather. This is what many people have done. They say, escape, renounce. Here there is no God. Go to the Himalayas. That silence is of the Himalayas. It has nothing to do with God. It is the silence of the cave. Come back after 30 years sitting in a cave to MG Road in Pune and finished all your silence and all your attainments, all gone. That's why renunciates become afraid of the world. They don't come. They cling to their cave. This is escapism. And this is not God that you can find only in the caves. God is everywhere. Only God is. He has to be everywhere. Even in the marketplace, He is as throbbing alive as in the Himalayas. In the Himalayas, He is silent. In the marketplace, He is noisy. But He is everywhere. When you are sitting unmoving, He is unmoving. And when you are running, He is running, but He is there. So the answer is rational, but not whole. Reason cannot answer for the whole. Reason divides. Reason analyzes. Reason dissects. It has dissected even God. God cannot be dissected. Even while you are ignorant, God is in you. He is your ignorance. Who else can be? And when you know, he is your knowing. God is your ignorance and God is your enlightenment. That's what Buddha means when he says the world is nirvana. It is one. These are two aspects of the same thing. Don't divide. You divide and you miss. The master dismissed the party. Aldous Huxley comments on this. He thinks he is a great philosopher in his own right. He thinks if he was there in the party, he would have suggested a better answer. What is his answer? He says, my own guess is that the tea party might have been prolonged at least for a few minutes. If Thai Soso had answered in some such way as this, if I cannot grasp Tathata in activity, then obviously I must cease to be I, so that Tathata may be able to grasp this ex-me and make it one with itself, not merely in the immobility and silence of meditation as happens to arhats, but also in activity as happens to bodhisattvas, for whom samsara and nirvana are identical. Now this is going even worse. And it is good that Aldous Huxley was not there. Otherwise he would have been beaten. The master has simply dismissed the party. That is great respect towards the disciple who has answered, simply dismissing it. Zen masters keep their staff by their side. And off they hit. Sometimes for no reason, no visible reason they hit. But one thing is always there. If they see that you are bringing your head too much, they hit your head. They say, slip out of it. They are saying, go deeper than the head, or higher than the head, don't cling with the head. This is too heady an answer. A guess won't do, Aldous Huxley. He says, this is my guess. A guess won't do, only experience. Nobody can guess. Nobody can suppose that this answer may have helped. No. A guesswork is a guesswork. It is rational. It is of the head, of the mind. Aldous Huxley would have gotten really beaten. This much philosophy would not be tolerated by his Zen master. That's why I insist so much for the irrational heights. You have to go above your heads. Always try one small experiment. Standing before the mirror, just think you have no head. Every day. Just 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, stand before the mirror and just look at the head and say, I don't have any head. Within 2-3 months, one day suddenly you will see the head has disappeared. You are standing there without a head. Then you will know what can be the answer. Not before it. You cannot guess. I know the answer, but I will not say. Because it cannot be said. The master was not asking for an articulate answer. The disciples had to do something. They had to act immediately in some way. They had to sow it. Some disciple had to sow it immediately, then and there, in his act, in his being. That it is there. And you cannot deceive a master. If it is not there, it is not there. If it is there, he will immediately feel it is there. It happens. A disciple comes to a master. The master has given him a koan. A koan is a special method to drive you crazy. It is a riddle which has no answer. The answer is not possible. The answer exists not. The disciple knows it. The master knows it. There is no answer, and the disciple has to find the answer. For months together, sometimes years together. Unless you find the answer, the master will not give you further instructions. Koan has to be solved. And the disciple knows that this is absurd. But it has to be solved. And deep down he knows, he has heard, he has read, that there is no answer, but the master says, go and find it. So, when you try to find an answer for something for which no answer exists, by and by you start getting berserk, crazy. You try and try, and it goes on slipping and slipping and slipping. In Japan, it is called Zen madness. In Japan, even doctors know it. Because sometimes it happens to the disciple and his family may take him to the doctor. Because he goes berserk. He starts shouting, doing things, screaming, shaking, quaking, trembling for no reason. Or he starts laughing or crying for no reason. Or he starts dancing. Sometimes the family will take the person to the doctor, but in Japan they know. And that has to be known all over the world. In fact, every medical college should teach the doctors a special course that there are people who are not really insane. Don't treat them, otherwise you will disturb them for their whole life. Your medicines, your electric shocks, your tranquilizers, your injections are dangerous. If the person is suffering from Zen madness, then you will destroy his all growth possibilities. In Japan, they won't treat. The moment they feel that this is a Zen disease, the first thing they inquire is the man in any way connected with any Zen master or Zen monastery. If he is connected, then take him to the master. Take him to the monastery. Don't bring him to the medical practitioner. A koan creates an artificial neurosis. We are carrying much neurosis within. Repressed it is. We are sitting on top of it. It is like a volcano. That Zen koan, that impossible riddle, goes on goading, and one day suddenly that volcano erupts, explodes. Then you are no more in control. You go beyond control. You cannot manage yourself. All your reason is gone in fragments. It has been an explosion and you are thrown away completely. You are no more the same as you have been before. Something new has happened. This Zen madness is the answer. The master will say, good, so it has happened. Now wait. Now just be patient. 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks at the most. The person has simply to wait, nothing to do. Eats, sleeps, takes his bath, as he feels. He is left alone in the monastery, in a small cottage, far away. Nobody goes to talk to him. Nobody is allowed to advise him. He simply relaxes there, takes a sun bath, lies on the grass, rolls on the grass, left alone, whatsoever he feels like doing, he does. When he wants to dance, he dances. When he wants to shout, he shouts. Only one thing is taken care of, that he should not do any violence to himself. And ordinarily, people never do. Very rarely somebody can go too much. Out of 100, only 1% cases. That care has to be taken off. The master and other disciples go on watching from far away. No violence should be done to himself or to somebody else, that's all. Within 3 weeks, 6 weeks, everything cools down. And the man comes with a new face, with his original face. Fresh, like dew drops in the morning. His eyes are innocent. He has passed through madness. He has gone beyond madness. He has entered the superconscious. Before you enter the superconscious, you will have to pass through a kind of crisis. This crisis is created by a koan. This crisis, I am creating it here with many methods. People who come from the outside just to watch cannot understand it. It is a Zen crisis. When people go berserk, they think this is driving people mad. What kind of religion is this? They don't know. Religion basically drives you mad so that you can go beyond madness. Once you have passed that barrier, you will never be mad. Once you have passed that barrier, you are a totally different kind of man. A new man is born. A great grace descends, and joy, and peace, and equilibrium. It is almost like making love. Millionfold. When you make love, what happens? Sexuality and spirituality are very alike. Sexuality is very small, atomic. And spirituality is vast, like the whole sky. But the difference is of quantity. But ultimately, quantitative difference leads to qualitative difference too. Millionfold. Great is the orgasm of spirituality. But it is an orgasm. It is exactly like sexual orgasm. When you are making love, what happens? First, tension starts mounting. More tension. Tension starts mounting. You start feeling crazy. A moment comes when you feel that if orgasm is not going to happen, you will go mad. The energy has to explode. And then the energy explodes. From a certain peak, the energy explodes. When the energy explodes, there is great joy. Because in that explosion, the ego disappears for a moment. You are no more. God is. You are no more. Tathata is. Only pure existence. Neither the woman is nor the man is. Both have disappeared into an orgasm. Both are pulsating into a different wavelength. But that is there only for a single moment, 1 moment, 2 moments, 3 moments. That joy. And then what happens? After the joy has settled, you cool down. Great peace arises. Great silence. You fall asleep in a beautiful slumber. This is a very tiny experience. Very, very tiny. Just like a straw. And spirituality is a jungle, the whole jungle. But you can understand it from it. This is your experience. And this experience can become a metaphor. In spirituality, the same happens on a very great expansion. Cosmic scale it happens. In meditation, in koan, in mantra, in chanting, in prayer, you go on creating a tension, and tension mounts and mounts, and it takes months, years, sometimes the whole life. And the mounting goes on and on and on, and tension becomes so much one day that there is no possibility to bear it anymore. then it explodes. And that explosion is of great joy, ecstasy. One dances, one laughs. And then the joy subsides into deep silence. One becomes cool, tranquil. One has arrived. But just as sexual orgasm is irrational, so is spiritual orgasm. All orgasmic experiences are irrational. That's why I insist for the irrational. The fourth question, why Zen is called the path of paradox? Religion as such has to be paradoxical. There is no other way. Because life consists of contradictions. They look contradictions to us. They are not in fact. They help each other. Have you not seen it in an arch? The architect does the same. He puts bricks against each other. If you put the bricks not against each other, you cannot make an arc. The house will fall. Half the bricks face this way and half the bricks face that way, and they both are there. They are the same bricks. You can put them facing in one line. The house will fall. But when they are put against each other, great energy is created. And that great energy becomes a strength. That's why man and woman create the child. Man alone cannot create. Woman alone cannot create. Bricks put opposite to each other become a great arc. Great energy is created. Life and death put against each other create the whole game, the whole play, the leela. Life in every dimension is paradoxical. So religion has to be paradoxical. If a religion is not paradoxical, then it is just poor philosophy. Then it is just man-made, mind-created, just a theology, not religion. One day, the emperor Liang Wuti invited Master Fu Tasi to expound the Diamond Sutra. As soon as he had ascended to his seat, the master knocked the table once with a ruler and descended from his seat. As the emperor was startled, the master asked him, "Does your majesty understand?" "I do not," replied the emperor. The saintly master said, "The bodhisattva has finished expounding the sutra. Just he has hit on the table with a ruler. And he says, I am finished with my discourse. I have said all that can be said on the Diamond Sutra. Diamond Sutra is the most precious Buddhist scripture." But only a Zen master can do such a strange behavior. But it is very meaningful. He has said all. Because the whole Diamond Sutra goes on repeating only one thing, again and again. Be aware. That is the whole message of all the Buddhas. Be aware. Don't be sleepy. Now this is a Zen way. He hits the table by a ruler. The emperor must be sitting there. He's sleepy, dreamy, mind somewhere else in 1001 places except there where he was sitting. Now by beating the table, suddenly the emperor is startled, must have become alert for a moment. And the message has been given. This is a non-linguistic way of giving messages. And not only this, the master says, the bodhisattva has finished expounding the sutra. He does not say, I have finished. He said, the Buddha has finished. Only a man who has disappeared into utter silence can say that Buddha has spoken through me. Another day, the emperor again asked, sir, come. I could not understand that great exposition. You come again. So the master came, wearing a robe, a hat, and a pair of shoes. The bodhisattva came to the palace where the emperor asked him, are you a monk? Because monks don't wear shoes. Buddhist monks don't wear shoes. And the bodhisattva is wearing shoes, so the emperor asked, are you a monk? In reply, the bodhisattva pointed a finger at his hat. Are you a Taoist? Asked the emperor. In reply, the bodhisattva pointed his finger at his shoes. Are you a lazy man? Asked the emperor. In reply, the bodhisattva pointed his finger at his monk's robe. What he is saying, I am all and I am none. You see, I have the hat of the monk. You see, I have the shoes of a Taoist saint. And how I can be lazy or a layman? You see my robe of ascetic practices, disciplines. I am all and I am none. The emperor said, I don't understand. Yesterday I missed, today I have again missed. The master says, this is my final exposition. Listen, and I will never come back again. If you understand, you understand. If you don't understand, you don't understand. And he said this gatha. The handless hold the hoe. A pedestrian walks riding on a water buffalo. A man passes over the bridge. The bridge, but not the water flows. And he went out of the palace and never came again. This is absurd what he says. The handless hold the hoe. How the handless can hold anything? But that is how it is happening. That who abides in you is handless and is holding all kinds of things. God is handless and is supporting the whole world. And you are handless in your innermost being. You don't have hands or legs or head. You are formless. But you are holding 1001 things. A pedestrian walks, riding on a water buffalo. And he says, a man is sitting on the water buffalo and is still walking. He is saying, God is taking you. You are riding on him and you think you have the responsibility to walk. It is like a beggar was passing and came the emperor in his chariot. And he took pity on the beggar, an old man. And the town was far away and the old man will have to drag himself. So he said to the old man, you come in. You sit in my chariot. The beggar was very much afraid. But you cannot say no to an emperor. He was very much afraid. A beggar and sitting with the emperor, it was too embarrassing. But you cannot say no. So he came up, sat in the chariot in one corner, very much afraid something may go wrong. But still keeping his bag on his head. After a little while, the emperor said, why don't you put your bag down? And the beggar said, sir, it is too much kind of you that you are carrying me in your chariot. I don't want to make more weight on your chariot. I will carry my bag on my head. Zen says, the doer, the only doer is God. Ar tathata, ar tau. You unnecessarily have become doers. Riding on a water buffalo and you are walking, unnecessarily walking, and water buffalo is carrying you. The river is taking you and unnecessarily you are swimming. Relax. A man passes over the bridge. The bridge, but not the water flows. This is tremendously beautiful. Very paradoxical. The bridge, but not the water flows. Zen people say, the body is a bridge. You pass through the body. You are like water, liquid, ungraspable, formless. You pass through the body. You don't change. The water flows not. Your water of life flows not. And the bridge goes on flowing. Your body goes on changing every day. One day it was child, another day it became young, then old, healthy, ill. The body goes on changing. Scientists used to say 10 years before that the body changes completely in 7 years. Totally. After 7 years you will not find a single iota of the old. All goes flowing out. Now they say it happens in 1 year, not 7 years. In 1 year's time, you don't have anything of the old. Everything changes. The body goes on throwing the old and goes on getting the new from food, from water, from air, goes on replacing. The body is a river-like flow. But body is the bridge. You are the passer. But you don't flow and the body flows. The bridge flows, the water does not flow. These paradoxical statements are of tremendous value. You can find them in all world mystics, in Eckhart, in Kabir, in Dadu, in Bohme, and more so in the Zen masters. Zen is a path of paradox. Listen to these lines of T.S. Eliot. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you don't own. And where you are is where you are not. These lines are perfect Zen, pure Zen. Meditate over these lines. Find out what T.S. Eliot means. These are very profound. It can be a koan for you. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. You don't know yourself. And that is the only thing you know. And if you don't know that, what else can you know? The knower knows only oneself. That is the only thing that can be known, because that is the only thing where we are. Everything else is at the most looked from the outside. It can become only an acquaintance. There is only one thing you can look from the inside, and that is you. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you don't own. See the point of it. What you own is the only thing you don't own. You own your house, but how can you own it? It was here, and you were not, and one day you will be gone, and it will be here. How can you own it? You come and go, and the house remains, and the world remains. You cannot own these things, you only pretend. And what you own is what you don't own. Seeing this, the Buddha leaves his palace. Seeing this, the Mahavir leaves his kingdom. Seeing this is not what I own, so why bother about it? It has to be taken away one day or other. So why be unnecessarily anxious about it? And where you are is where you are not. Have you watched it? Where you are, people are in their bodies. There you are not. People are in their minds, and there you are not. Your reality is somewhere else beyond the body and behind the mind. Meditate over these lines. All profound truths are paradoxical. Hence I call Zen the path of paradox. Enough for today. Thank you.